what to this?
We'll have till 1:15. We've got an extension.
Well, you must tell me if I go on too long. I'm rather moving. I'm taking Godelier's invitation to have the license to move outside his own framework, and therefore what I say may or may not be relevant. Now, my copy of Godelier's really excellent paper is marked with assent, and sometimes extremely warm assent, at very, very many points. And in particular, in his polemical situation in relation to Althusserian thought and its typology of levels of instances of institutional structures, particularly and essentially and very crucially his location of ideality within material life, and at very many other points. But my assent is withheld. I don't say rejected, but for the time being withheld from some of his more formal proposals and his reorganization of these proposals. For various reasons, I am bothered by his continuing use of a metaphor of infrastructure and superstructures, but a simple replacement of institutions by functions. And I'm bothered also, as I think one or two others here are, by his concepts of ideology. Now, I'm saying withheld but not rejected. Now, withheld for two reasons, apart from difficulties in his thought, which may very well become apparent when cleared up, when we see the full book that this is a part of. One is that I agree with Bloch that I find insufficient space for the concept of contradiction, and in particular for the concept of class within his formulation. Now, he says that space is there, and no doubt he can develop it, but I don't think it's accidental that several of us felt this space was unclear, that the dialectic of social being and social consciousness doesn't seem to me to be clearly placed there. Now, the second difficulty, and this takes me outside this framework, is the difficulty of an old dog to learn new tricks. I introduced myself partly as jest to Gellner's annoyance as a Marxist empiricist. This was partly a joke. I have written about this in various places. I'm talking about a specific British Marxist tradition, very notably in historiography, which has worked within an empirical mode, which is very distinct from empiricism. That is, it has worked within an educational and intellectual tradition in England, and in some sense subdued itself to this empirical mode. And this is quite an old and long-standing tradition in Marxist historiography. I mean, Godelier says, we have no good Marxist books on religion, yet the central problem, which has been confronted by one of the major Marxist historians in Britain, Christopher Hill, has been precisely religion. Puritanism has been at the very center of his very formidable historical practice, which has transformed very many areas of historical consciousness in the past 30 years. The first person who had a profound influence historiography upon me. I can't speak for this tradition, although some are people, say Hilton or Hill, or in some ways Morris Dobb, people with whom I had been associated, and I take my own, as you do, my own idiosyncratic positions. But I think two things ought to be said about this tradition. One is that if you examine its productions, there is very little concern with the typology of infrastructure and superstructures in it, but very much concern with the mode of production and productive relationship, with the location of contradiction within societies, with the concept of class, and in modern historiography, very much with culture and both material and culture-forming processes from below, as well as dominance from above. And this is true of 17th, 18th, 19th century British Marxist historiography. In a certain sense, I felt that Keith Hopkins also was working within a tradition which was very recognisably close. And I don't want to close this as a Marxist tradition. Marxismo and other areas we have very much in common. The second thing to say about it is that it is being within the empirical mode has been insufficiently self-conscious about its own conceptualization, and therefore has, I think, often led to the illusion that it hasn't had its conceptualization. Now, there are various historical reasons for this. One was that it developed originally within Stalinist forms in which intense debates never surfaced and could never surface. We had these debates, which were highly conceptual. They were concerned with all these questions like relative autonomy and so on, which is where we started from 20 and 30 years ago. And then it showed itself as a practice. So that my problem with Godelier is that I reach some, in very important areas, similar conclusions to him, but I've reached them by a different road, and therefore it's very difficult immediately to give assent to another road, another way of doing it. Now, in my own case, this includes a quite specific refusal, now 20 years old, and repeated in many points of my work. But there's no reason why people should know these, because often it appeared in rather obscure periodicals like the Socialist Register, of the concept of infrastructure and superstructure. It is, in my view, a metaphor which cannot be reformed, which is radically corrupt, which carries within it tendencies towards dualism, both ideal, material dualism, tendencies towards the building of unreal hierarchies, tendencies towards the divorce of ideas and norms from material being, and so on. And the most elaborate sophistication seemed to me always to return to the same problems. Now, whether Godelier has at last found a way of escaping this, I don't know. I want to study his work. This doesn't entail a refusal of the dialectic of social being and social consciousness, or of what I tried to describe as culture and not culture, and to define not culture is very difficult. The metaphor of basis and superstructure is, I think, an unsatisfactory one. It's not, of course, the only one which Marx uses. It's not one which Marx uses very often. He uses it critically in the introduction to Critique of Political Economy. He uses some extremely interesting alternative metaphors, for example, in the Grundrisse. I haven't brought it here, but it's very familiar to us all, this extraordinary and scientifically inaccurate metaphor about specific gravity. The mode of production gives us the a special ether in which the colours of all social relations are bathed according to a specific mode of production. A very different type of metaphor which he's using there, which, despite its scientific inaccuracies, is one that is more germane to my way of seeing things. The other problem of the metaphor basis and superstructure is that it gives us a static model-building, formalist typology for categories which, to my mind, are essentially historical categories. And I think it's interesting that Marx, who, after all, was a very formidable philosophical thinker and who did develop a formal typology of the capitalist mode of production, in all his writings did very little to develop this kind of formal typology of process in general, even of class and the formation of consciousness, because his categories, as I say. Now, to explain what I mean by Marx's historical epistemology and historical categories, I think would take too long. What I mean in shorthand is that these categories arise from the repeated observations of regularities of social and intellectual process over time, and that these give rise to categories expressive of a logic of process. I would say not law. I think law of motion traps us again in various positions which Popper, among others, correctly criticized, but a logic of process and a logic inherent to particular modes of production. And therefore, I think just as we have always this problem about class, that when you try and stop society and take a formal typology and say where your classes are, I think you get incorrect and formal. And indeed, I think Althusser is continually repeating these incorrect formal levels of instances, because class in itself is a historical category derived from this observation over time of process and logic of process. And it, like all history, never sleeps or dies, but held one moment burns the hand. I think Althusser's hands are absolutely charred. we can't also identify ideology in the same kind of way by trying to stop process and identifying ideological and non-ideological thought. Because the statement social being determines social consciousness is, in any sense, first of all, it's not an absolute statement, I don't think. It's a polemical statement as opposed to dominant views of the time that social consciousness determines social being. Secondly, it's not an epistemological statement. It's not a statement that being determines consciousness. It's a statement about the sociology of knowledge, about the processes by which social ideas are formed, coming from the observation of process over time. And being concerned with the historical sociology of knowledge, it seems to me to be about the way in which certain ideas, from the pool of ideas, certain ideas are selected, endorsed by institutions, formulated in modern societies in educational forms, to give rise to a legitimating ideology, which is something quite distinct from those ideas, conforming to the interests of particular groups. And I think no example of the formation of ideology is more relevant than Soviet and orthodox Marxist ideology itself, which is clearly a ideological formation derived from a pool of Marxist ideas. And the two things are quite distinct. Yes, ideology gives rise to, from ideology we can study certain characteristic illusions or deep structures, and I agree, and I think this is an advance of modern Marxist thought, the consciousness of the way in which it can give rise to certain categories which reach right down to the level of consciousness itself. But these seem to me to be already always in friction with another category, experience. And indeed, it is experience, particularly, which I think is central to our problem now. It's a category which requires a great deal more examination, and one which is crucial, I think, to the whole problem of social change. Okay, I mean, we all know experience is not innocent. We all know there are impurities in experience. But equally, historians, and I think anthropologists, know that experience is not illusory. That is, certain philosophic accounts of experience, which concentrate upon the impurity, epistemological impurity of experience, are simply at odds with the material which historians handle every day of their working lives. That is, experience breaks into the historian's study without any knocking in the form of demographic crises, technological change, sexual technology, the birth control pill, crises of subsistence, wars, and the kind of succession of consequences which Keith Hopkins has just given us. This is the kind of way in which experience breaks through. And I think in the particular tradition I was referring to, our work in popular culture is rather relevant if we're concerning change. Am I going on too long?
If you could move towards the conclusion
now. Well, I would have now then to reinsert.
Let me go on. I would gladly give up my time this afternoon. I want to say half. I mean, my words would be
Godelli said, and I think probably really we are saying very similar things. He said that the concept of ideology has to be placed alongside an elaborated concept of power. And I would say that, I would simply rephrase this in terms of the concept of ideology arises within the context of a concept of contradiction, which is in societies which I have observed mediated by class, and this contradiction can be seen in two ways. First, as a contradiction of interest, but also as a contradiction of differential experience. Again, a category I haven't fully examined. And in terms of differential experience, this can be seen in one sense in terms of a contradiction in ideas. And we have to remember that in medieval and early modern society, much of the practice of that society was a mystery of apprenticeship, which was transmitted by the workers, the skilled workers themselves. And the ruling class could not conceivably have carried on the practice of its own society. And one can't talk about that practice as ideology. And secondly, in the sense that there are alternative norms in any society. And much of our work has been concerned with the culture-forming process, the way in which, from below, foresters or handloom weavers or particular kinds of working community form their own necessary normative, their own value system, which is partly defensive and partly protective, which does not give rise to dispensing with the notion of an overarching, dominant hegemony within which, well, this whole question is another question, but one I would love to talk about, but I think I better not. But we return then to this question of social being determines social consciousness. Within social being, we have then to define the involuntary, compulsive, and received, including ideation and norms, components of material life. Social consciousness is how men handle this received experience in cultural ways. So that our critical problems are those of determination, and those of change require not so much a theory of power as a specific examination of contradiction inherent in specific modes of production, the kind of thing Keith Hopkins was doing, kind of dialogue which went on about the transition from feudalism to capitalism, which Rodney Hilton and others were engaged in, have been engaged in over the years. Could I perhaps just jump to a final comment, which is about this question of the question which I think that Godelier very importantly placed before us, this question of the reciprocity of relations in a system of domination. Now, this is a thing which I have been for some time studying, particularly in relation to 18th century society. In one sense, you can see this in a dichotomy, in a friction between law on the one hand and custom on the other hand. Domination is never absolute. But given a certain equilibrium of classes, one can see, and this was a very long equilibrium in British society from late 17th to the early 19th century, you can see, in fact, a society functioning with stability, reproducing itself, not without conflict, but with particular modes and institutional devices and means of handling and resolving conflict. And within this, one finds many local resistances. One finds particular modes of work, particular kinds of community, engendering and nourishing alternative modes, and one finds the possibility of kinds of revolt and alternative ideas developing. This overarching domination is, if you like, the common sense of a society, given the ruling relations of that society, which is accepted as part of the daily experience of people as how to get through their life with the minimum of trouble. They can't get through life without it. But implicit in the notion of reciprocity, in any society I've studied, is that to maintain their legitimation, the rulers must not only seem to, but be actually seen to perform certain functions. And they are to that degree, I think, actually prisoners of the rule. Not absolute prisoners, but in the sense that unless they perform those functions, their legitimacy will be challenged. And in the 18th century, one sees this continually, particularly in a crucial relation in the bargaining over prices, the food riot. This is true also of France, in which the legitimacy of the rulers depends upon their handling this very critical moment in social experience, shortage of food, danger of a subsistence crisis, and their manifest ways of appearing to intervene and of actually intervening with the sanction of riot imposed from below. So that here you have an equilibrium in which both parties are, in fact, in a kind of reciprocal relation, although one is dominating and one is dominated. So that when we are concerned with the question of social change, one, I think, must have a concept of contradiction. One must have, I think, a concept of the epochal conditions, the logic of process of a given mode of production, and the limits beyond which that can't be transcended. And into that, one has to reinsert this lost question in this debate, this question of agency. This question of agency, and I'm afraid that Marx was, if we were to denounce humanism, Marx was to be severely denounced for the humanism of his historical consciousness. His insistence upon human agency is ever present there. And we have then to examine once more the whole notion of, and the actual term, determination. Are we meaning, when we say determination within a given mode of production, that there are certain limits which cannot be transcended within that mode of production, that there are certain possibilities which may be immense within that mode of production, but beyond that there are other possibilities which are absolutely rejected, that a logic of process is involuntary within that logic of process, but within that logic of process many alternatives may be possible? Is that what we're saying? Or by determined, are we saying something much more deterministic? Now, I tend to take the first position, although I think what Braudel describes as material life in its determining force is more absolute than the mode of production. That is, I think there are geological, demographic determinations which are more absolute than the determinations of a mode of production, whose determinations are those of logic of process and epochal limits which can't be transcended. Agency exists within those determinations, and then if you were to ask how you transcend those determinations, you have to turn to the essential notion of contradiction and where that contradiction reaches a point that equilibrium can no longer be reconciled within that society. I'm sorry to go on so long.